Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for December 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by my long-lost co-host and friend, Tim Nelson. Tim, it's been too long since we've sat across from each other and talked film together.
It's been far too long, John. I blame myself because it's my fault, actually.
It is his fault. That's true. But we forgive him because that's what we're like here. And so the truth of the matter is, if you've been following along on our feed, we did not have a podcast for November. It's the first month in quite a while that we didn't get one out there, and we feel terrible for it. And I know some people probably didn't notice, but I notice these things. There's a few podcasts I have that I get super protective about, and there's this one in particular, they haven't posted something for 2 months, and I'm always just checking, like, come on. And there's got to be at least one listener out there that's been doing that for us. And if you are listening to this, we're sorry from the bottom of our heart, and thank you for sticking around. And we're going to make it up to you, because we've decided that as a special Christmas gift and reconciliation gift, that we are going to do two podcasts in the month of December.
Two for one, baby.
Two for one. So in a couple weeks, there will be another show in December as well as one in January. So hang on tight. There's two coming your way.
It's perfect for the Christmas holiday. Sitting around with your Uncle Mort, you know, trying to figure out what to do. Just put some headphones in and kind of zone out to our soothing voices.
Yes. Tim's voice especially is very soothing. I could fall asleep to that voice.
I do. Mm. Fall asleep to my own voice.
Tim, this is like the greatest time of the year for me. Movies just coming out left and right, and they're all good. It's so wonderful. I mean, like, there are probably six movies playing right now that are great and worth seeing. I love it.
It's like, why don't they spread this out, especially during the summertime, right?
Totally. I know.
And we need the air conditioning. Come on.
I mean, I had the privilege of seeing Moonlight a few weeks ago, which you have not seen yet still, right?
I have not seen yet. Everything I've read about Moonlight says I should go see it two or three times right now.
Absolutely. Still the best movie I've seen this year. And, I mean, I have a hard time believing anything could top it, but apparently there is a movie out there that does. We'll talk about that later. But so Moonlight is fantastic, and there's just so many good movies out there, and that's what it's all about. Yep, they cram it all into December and January, and here we are. So, but the movie we are going to be talking about is one that people have been buzzing about for quite a while, and it's lighting up the awards circuit, and it is a little film called Manchester by the Sea. And Tim, I've waited a long time for this movie. I've got to tell you, I first heard about Manchester by the Sea all the way back in January of this year. It premiered at Sundance at the end of January, and so we're on Twitter, Cinema
Faith. Gravy, man.
I know.
It's been around a while.
Yeah, at Cinema Faith is our Twitter handle. And so, you know, I get on there every now and then, and I'm looking and seeing what other people are posting. And I happen to be on Twitter that night that, like, everyone in the world apparently had been to Sundance and seen Manchester by the Sea. And it was, like, tweet after tweet after tweet. This is going to win Best Picture. This is the movie to see. Best movie of the festival, blah, blah, blah. And I just couldn't believe it. And so I've been waiting this entire time to see this movie, and finally it just came out a week ago. And this is what bugs me about living in Milwaukee a little bit, because we have a great film festival. From all accounts, from everyone who's been a part of it, it's a good film festival. But what bothers me is that there seems to be other film festivals that get movies like this all year. Like, it went to Toronto, it went to Philadelphia. Like, why can't we be in one of those cities where we could have seen this movie in June? Like, bugs me a little bit.
Which our film festival is relatively late in the year, though, isn't it?
It's around October. But so I don't know. I mean, like, I think they're just going for a different vibe. I think they're going for more the local filmmakers, and I don't know. It'd be nice, but it's okay. We're patient around here, and we wait for the long haul. We have to wait till, like, you know, it says limited opening in December or whatever, and then you wait another, like, 2 or 3 weeks after that, and finally it gets here, and that's what happened with Manchester by the Sea. So we finally saw it, and it was worth the wait, I am proud to report. So Manchester by the Sea is what we're talking about today. Tim, where is Manchester? Do you know where?
Boston, I thought.
Near Boston.
Near Boston, so yes. Massachusetts.
No, New Hampshire.
Oh, it's in New Hampshire?
Yeah,
I don't even know this.
I am fairly certain it's in New Hampshire.
So it's New England.
Yes.
Okay. Can I just use vague terms?
Go for it.
That's the best I can do here.
Do you know anything about it? Like, any fun facts about Manchester?
I wasn't prepared. I did not look up anything about either. That at all.
I thought you would have them.
See, like I told you, I usually have these facts, and for some reason, I've been busy and sick, and I don't have the fun facts about. See, like you, I didn't even know. I thought it was in Massachusetts. I was totally wrong about
that. I Googled that much, but. I mean, we do know that according to the film, it is close to Boston. It's also apparently pretty close to New York City. So it's kind of right near a bunch of these big cities in the U.S. It seems to be kind of an upscale city from what we see in the film. Like it's a boating community. There's a lot of, I don't know, it just seems upscale to me. That's the vibe I got.
It's like a fishing, I think we get this idea of the fishing town, right?
Yes.
This is kind of like the New England version of the coal mining town.
And that's how the movie begins, is with shots of these boats swirling around the water. That's the first thing you see. So yeah, it's definitely a boating community. And the first scene actually takes place on a boat. And Tim, I know you are a huge believer in the first scene of a movie. This is like what you talk about all the time. Can you explain to our listeners why the first scene of a movie is so important, and what, and if you could describe the first scene of Manchester?
I'll do my best. Okay. It was like midnight when we were watching this thing.
It's all right.
So the first scene to me, a lot of times, like an artist, especially a good writer, like we have here, will use the first scene to kind of summarize everything that they're talking, like their entire film will be summarized in the first scene. It's kind of like artistic statement. And so in this scene, you have three characters they kind of come up on this fishing boat. It's a commercial fishing boat, so it's used to make a living, but they're actually just fishing for fun today. It's a young boy, and it's his uncle who's helping him fish, and then dad who is piloting the boat up front.
We don't really see him. He's just kind of driving. Right.
Right. And so we have the dad, and the uncle is just talking with him and kind of harassing him, kind of razzing him, just having a good time. And he asks him, I think, a question, something along the lines of, if you were going to be with one person that would help you survive, who would that person be? And he'd say, my dad, the kid says. And he's like, oh, that's just because you don't know me well enough. If you knew me well enough, it would be me. I would be the one that you'd want to have around if it was just one guy to survive in a survival situation. So he's talking about this, and it just seems like small talk, and they're messing around.
Mm-hmm. And it could be mistaken for a throwaway scene, but it's not when you think back.
It looks like a throwaway scene. It just looks like, it just looks like people fishing and messing around. And so he helps the boy catch this fish. And so then they have one fishing rod, and they're working together, and they're catching the fish. And the dad, the captain, is obviously putting him on fish.
So we'll get some more of the significance of that a little bit later, but that's the first scene of the movie that you see. And one thing you see from that first scene is that this main character, played by Casey Affleck, is Lee, and he's a happy guy, right? He's joking around with his nephew, and he seems to be in good spirits. And the next scene that you see when we cut to present day, he's not a happy man. Lee is actually a very depressed man, very angry. He lives alone in this small, dinky apartment that's like beneath the ground. Like, you see people walking by on top all the time. He's a maintenance man for an apartment complex, and he's really irritable with the tenants. He's prone to lash out. He gets talked to by his boss for repeatedly kind of lashing out at these admittedly inept tenants. But this is not a happy man. And something has happened to Lee that has caused this transformation, and we don't know what it is. And that is what we will get to in a little bit here. But we have to start off, when we talk about Manchester by the Sea, we're talking about Casey Affleck in the main role of Lee. Tim, the first thing you said when we were going to see this is that you love Casey Affleck. What do you like about him as an actor?
I'm not the acting guy. I always
That's okay.
I'm more like into the writing.
Yeah. Well, what have you seen him in that you really liked? Like, what makes you say, I really like that guy?
I think he's got a little bit of this, like, because you got Ben Affleck. That's who I thought of because I'm from the 90s.
Yep.
But he's got a little bit of, like, the Jesse Pinkman in him. It's
from,
like,
Breaking Bad?
Yeah, Breaking Bad. Uh-huh. Which is Walter.
Walter's like punk assistant.
Yeah, he's like, he makes the drugs, but he also uses the drugs. There's this edginess to Affleck that you go, that makes it really believable that he experienced like he was abused, or he went through something difficult. But he has a street toughness kind of feel to him.
Yes.
And I don't know how to explain that. It's not right out there like you might get with an actor like Mark Wahlberg or something where you're like, you know, similar area kind of idea. But it's not like that. It's like this like deep kind of resilience that you get in him. And it's so surprising because I would never have guessed that he was even related to Ben Affleck.
Yeah. They don't even have the same stature. They're like night and day. Totally. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I like that. He just seems really unpredictable in some ways.
That's what I like about him too, is that he feels this is not a cookie cutter actor, especially in his roles and his choices that he makes. I mean, he's been in some big movies, like he's in Ocean's 11s, 11, 12, yeah, and 13. But he's also chosen some really weird roles. I mean, do you remember there's this movie that he made with Joaquin Phoenix, which I think is his cousin. I think they're related. Maybe. Sheesh. Maybe not. I don't know. That don't quote me on that. But anyway, there was this experiment they did called I'm Still Here, where like Joaquin Phoenix announced that he was quitting acting and he was going to start a rap career. Do you remember this?
Yes.
And it was like this public stunt that they did, and they were making this documentary during this time where they were like fooling everyone, and they would go on Letterman and they would just play it all seriously, deadpan.
I remember this.
And then there was this documentary, and it was just, I mean, I don't think that movie like really worked, and it was pretty obvious that it was a stunt, but still, that's the point, is that he's not afraid to take risks, and he's not afraid to be unflattering. There was a movie with Brad Pitt called The Assassination of
Jesse James
by the coward Robert Ford, and he was really good in that, and he's a sleazeball in that, so he's not afraid to take risks, and he's a really good actor, and I think this could be his best role to date. I mean, I've never seen him better than in this movie, hands down. There's so much emotion that's required from him. I mean, in a way, Lee's a guy who suppresses his emotions and he keeps it bottled inside of himself, but that could easily become a one-note kind of performance where he's just emotionally dead, but it's not. It, like, for instance, Tom Hanks is getting all this buzz about being nominated for Sully, which just drives me nuts, because like I thought that role, and I love Tom Hanks, I'm a huge Tom Hanks defender, but I thought that role was extremely one-note, and everybody's like, oh yeah, but that the real Sully in real life, that's how he is. He doesn't show a lot of emotion. Like, okay, well, but you still have to bring something else.
I think in the character development difference
mm-hmm.
with this is, with Tom Hanks, you want, like, you're already like predisposed to thinking this guy's a good guy. Even in like, for instance, like, let's take like Saving Private Ryan, right? That's most people have seen that film. Like, you already, like, no matter what he does in battle, you're kind of like, yeah, he's this pretty decent guy. But like Casey Affleck, you're like, pretty sure he's a dirtbag. Let's see what he does. Yeah, you know?
That's so, even in Road to Perdition, you're still kind of like, well.
He's a pretty nice guy, probably.
He's killing people, but, you know.
Yeah, so I think, like, he's almost, I think that's more interesting, especially for this film.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want a character that you don't trust. Like, I think a lot of times you have especially a leading man that, you know, even you kind of trust already. And I feel the unpredictability of Affleck in this, and the sense of like that he's done the wrong thing before. And you get that right off from the second scene mm-hmm. where he's like this janitor, and he just seems like grumpy, and like you're like, man, what? And he lives in this basement apartment. And you're like, what did the dude do? You know, like that's kind of like begging the question.
Absolutely. And then he goes to this bar, and he's just sort of like sitting alone. And there's these two guys that happen to glance at him, and then he walks over there and is basically like, hey, do you know me? And they're like, no. And then he just decks one of them in the face. This outburst of anger, mm-hmm. you know, and something has done this. But I just think that like, so in a way, he suppresses his emotions, but it's not. We still get a lot of range out of his performance because you can tell there's cracks in his foundation that he can't quite contain it, right? Like you see like it wanting to get out, and you actually see that in his eyes, and so I just think there's a lot of depth to what he brings to the table in this character. It's not just like, oh, he doesn't emote much. Right?
And like it's like a nervous energy that doesn't. You know, I don't know if he's a method actor. I don't know
I don't either. Styles. Yeah.
But there's a nervous energy that comes from him where he's like stammers sometimes in scenes, and it's more true to life.
Yes.
I know when we did the Linklater film, what, earlier this year?
Yeah. What's that movie called?
Everybody Wants Some.
Yes, Everybody Wants Some. Yep. Two exclamation
points. We talked about like believability, and I think sometimes the script, I think, helped him, but there was other parts where that you could not, I'm sure they were not, they're like guttural, you know, like that he's, and kind of, yeah, but you can feel tension in his face.
Yes.
And in his mannerisms.
Absolutely.
His, and his, like the way his body moves, he's very shifty sometimes. And I, you know, I just don't, I don't even know how to describe a technique. I think if there was like some technique, you know, for that, I think that, you know, it wouldn't be so good.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how to describe it, but I know it's there. That's the best I can say.
Yep. That's right. And so the question is, why is Lee so different in this first scene with his nephew into what we see him in the present day? And the way that it's revealed is through flashbacks. So the writer and director of this movie is Kenneth Lonergan, who most people, I think, would remember maybe from You Can Count on Me. That was his last big movie.
That he directed.
That he wrote and directed. Yeah.
Or Margaret, but that's like a weird one.
And I've never seen or heard of Margaret. But yeah, I knew that he did that. But did you see that?
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I just know it has a good reputation.
Yep. Okay. But you saw You Can Count on Me.
Yep.
With Mark Ruffalo, which is this really, really offbeat, like, sweet movie about a brother and a sister. And you can only, like, you probably name the amount of movies on your hands about a brother and sister, but like that, it's just, and it's got this really sweet relationship between them, and Mark Ruffalo knocks it out of the park. And it's just, yeah, what did you think of You Can Count on Me?
So, you, what I think is so funny is like the You Can Count on Me, the title of the movie, is actually that what they don't say in a scene in that movie.
They don't say it at all.
He says, "You remember what we used to say to each other when we were kids?" And then he pauses and he hugs his sister, and that's the I'm assuming
that's good
the title.
Writing. Yes. Yeah.
When he's trying to assure her that he will come back someday. What I think about that movie? Sorry, I'm like getting deep
no,
in the movie.
No, good.
No context for our listeners. I thought it was a good movie. I think both of these movies border on melodrama.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I think that is the only place where I would say that this is there's some weakness here, is it gets a little bit so emotionally driven that I think it's really, it's hard to like kind of, you're almost, it's not manipulation, but it's a little bit over the top, all these sets of circumstances.
That's fair. And I think that's true. And I tend to love that. Like, give me a emotional drama where people are yelling at each other, like over an action movie any day. There's just something about it. Like Revolutionary Road, you know, where DiCaprio and Winslet are just like fighting in the bedroom. Like, that to me is like, ugh. But there's some people that absolutely hate movies like that. I know one in particular, friend of mine, that just like is so opposed to family dramas. Like, it's just like, oh, you'd rather die than see movies like that. And that's what kind of Lonergan specializes in.
Well, it feels like the trend has been in Hollywood has been these analytical movies that like the analysis brings out emotion. Like, I know I talk about this like every podcast. But when we reviewed like a Snowden, right?
Oh yeah.
Or it's like over the top CGI movies. And so to have something that would even would be like a classic tragedy or something that almost fit into some of these ancient forms is really weird. It really stands out, I think, more so than it would have 10 years ago. So I look at You Can Count on Me, and that was like, yeah, it was there. He won what? Did he win for best screenplay?
That's a great question.
I think
know
he did,
it
or
was
he got nominated.
Yeah, I think he was nominated.
And so like it was on the radar, but now like I feel like this, and that movie has so many similarities to Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really similar plot devices. He's using death in the same way. I know we don't want to like mess up any of the film for our listeners.
No, no.
But he's using death as a major kind of plot device. He's using regret. He's using characters who are incredibly damaged and who have damaged others. It says real life. But I would say that stands out in this kind of era that we're in, which is like hyper analytical,
or the age of the superhero that we're entrenched in, right?
Yeah. So, or the age of the superhero. Like I was watching Spotlight again the other day, because I was like, "Is this really that great of a movie? I need to watch it again."
It's overrated.
And so I'm looking at Spotlight, and it's really interesting, but it's in some ways it's very emotionless. There's a couple scenes of the victims that have some emotion.
Wait a second. I said that when Spotlight came out, and you disagreed with me. You were arguing. I don't remember. I think
can
it was
I
on
change
the podcast.
My mind, man?
I'm so frustrated because the first thing I said when I got out of that movie is like, in my head, I get that there is emotion, but I don't feel it at all. That's the first thing I said when I walked out of there.
You're right.
I tweeted about
it.
Go back and look.
I was wrong. Yeah, you're right. Well, I mean, compared to this, because there's pockets of emotion in that, but the idea is more that you would be overwhelmed by a message or the data of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like a macro film. So like, it's like a system. So look at how this impacts a system. And these
it's like
films,
emotions as directed by a computer or something.
Well, these films are all like these little micro things that seem to be like really isolated to a few individuals, like family dramas, like we were talking about. And it stands out. I don't know if it's better it's hard to compare the two. They're very similar.
Than what?
Than
Spotlight?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, it's better.
Oh, no, it's better than Spotlight.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's better than You Can Count on Me is better than Manchester. I doubt that.
That's an interesting debate. Yeah. I would have to see it again. It's been a while, but yeah. But you're right. They're very similar films, and they touch on that same genre. Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely.
But yeah, they definitely, for me, they kind of harken back to like the 80s.
In some ways. It feels old fashioned. You're absolutely right.
Where you have these really small group of people who experience some really intense things together, and it maybe just impacts them versus something that's like a bigger narrative or. Yeah, so it's it's not an epic. It's very small. It's like a short story or something almost.
Yes, and so the way that Lonergan directs, I don't know quite how to explain it. I would say that his films do borderline on slow. I think that's fair to say, but I didn't ever feel bored in Manchester, but he does take his time with scenes. The scenes are they're longer than usual. There's a point where most Hollywood films would cut to the next thing, and he just lingers there on the same room and the same thing. But it works because it's almost like in the same way that the movie keeps revealing layers to you, each scene keeps revealing kind of another layer. And I think it's a really unique way of directing that
It seems like he uses the scenery and he uses the shots to give you kind of like it's almost like he uses some like artwork or to draw you into ideas of things. So like the apartment, his basement apartment looks like a prison cell.
Yes.
And so he makes you sit there. He also does like one of the things I brought up, and this is something that John Ford did in The Searchers, which is he does all these scenes of the Affleck character being unable to enter into homes or at the doorway but can't go in.
Yeah, and he's constantly getting invited to dinners, and you're right, and he always turns it down. Yeah, that's a good point.
And so the idea is like so he's using these shots, and he has like even framed sometimes he'll frame a home with the face of Affleck. And it's like so it makes it really clear you're not in the house right now. You're not in a home. And then when he's in the home, he tends to look, he looks super uncomfortable all the time.
Yes.
So even like, he's like, aren't you going to take this bedroom? He just looks uncomfortable the whole time when he's in a home. So, or when he's at the breakfast table or any of those things, like the way he shot those scenes is to make it look like the idea of home or the idea of permanence is like really hard for him. And then he also combines those with nature, these beautiful scenes of the sea.
Yes. Which is kind of like the frame of reference that he keeps going back to. It's how the movie opens and he returns to it again and again. Yep.
Yeah. So the miracle of the iPhone just happened, where I looked up Manchester by Sea.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out there was two Manchesters. One was in New Hampshire. One was in Massachusetts, and they actually renamed the Manchester in Massachusetts Manchester by the Sea in 1989.
Get out.
No, it's true. How confusing is that?
Wow. There's your fun fact.
So here's what I also found out about it. It used to be a town full of blue collar fishermen for 200 years, and then it became a place for the elite and the wealthy to live for the last 50 years. And
so I was right about it being kind of upscale.
Yes, okay. You're absolutely right about that.
That's the vibe I got from it. Yeah.
So the idea is it went from 200 years of like working class fishermen into the last 50 years of elitist, kind of like buying up all the real estate, and then they have the view of the sea, you know?
So what you're saying is that the Manchester that takes place, that the movie takes place in, is the one in Massachusetts that's by the sea.
It's and they the one in Massachusetts. Okay. Yeah, but that's super confusing because I had no idea. Thank you, iPhone.
But
I think that was such a great first question because I think it does play, that history plays into it. And for me, the idea of like with his brother, he wanted to get buried with the rich people. I mean, that's interesting, right? And he's a fisherman.
Yes.
And so the idea is he wants to be, you know, there's something there. So I think the setting makes sense. It reminds me a little bit, if you ever read the Steinbeck novel, The Winter of Our Discontent.
No.
That. They both take place in winter in small New England towns that are used to be run by the fishing industry. But anyway, it reminded me, it had the same vibe of that book.
So the primary way that Lonergan starts to introduce us to these characters in a deeper way is through flashbacks. And there's something about the way he uses flashbacks that felt different to me than typical Hollywood flashbacks. What is it? Did you think about what is that feels so different about it?
So when I watched it, we went and we watched this really late at night, and that's probably one of the reasons I feel a little sick right now. But we watched it really late at night. My first impression was that he kind of follows emotional lines, like in the flashbacks. So it's like, why would a character in the scene feel this way? And then he'll go to an event that would have made them feel that way or would explain the scene before.
That's great insight. Yep.
And so usually flashbacks are used almost like, I mean, I think about flashbacks using other films as almost like, let's rebuild the puzzle, or like it's some kind of puzzle that we're supposed to build, or a riddle. And I don't feel like there's the big aha moment in this film, but I don't feel like he's using the flashbacks in a chopped up way to make us have just enough pieces to reconstruct something. It's more following the emotional line of that character. And so I thought that was kind of brilliant. Because it isn't just going back to arbitrary. It's following, like, what made that character have that emotion in this scene? And then it'll go back into the flashback, which I think we all have those things in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be an event that causes, that's 10 years ago, that is the direct cause of an emotion that I might have today.
That's good. And also the flashbacks don't, like flashbacks usually come like from a mile away, right? Like I was just watching The Two Towers, because I always go to the Lord of the Rings every Christmas, and like in The Two Towers extended edition, you have this close up of Faramir, and like the camera slowly pans to his face, and then you fade to a flashback, and then it literally comes back, and he's still thinking about that. You know, that is like an arrival of an announcement. But like this one, it's like you have a present day scene, and then bam, you have a flashback scene, and then you're back in the present, and so it almost feels like the past and the present are just circling around each other.
That's a good way to put it, John. I think that's the idea. I mean, mm-hmm. Isn't the idea is that the Affleck is a product of the past, and he can, in some ways cannot escape his past.
Yep.
And so that it becomes the primary. I mean, that's a reference point for every part of his life. I mean, I think we're used to like a narrative where it would have, you have, okay, a character wants something. Like even, you know, like when you're talking about how to write a screenplay, it's the character has to want something, right?
Yep.
And so you have a character that wants something, and then you add tension. So like the character wants a lot of money, so he decides he's going to pull a heist. Okay, and then you add tension because you add a cop is in the bank, an off-duty cop, right? This is like every movie you've ever seen. This doesn't do that. The tension actually exists in the past, not in the present.
That's it.
There's some present tension that precipitates, but everything points back. And I think that you don't have a lot of films like that. Most films are trying to be very present and are trying to create tension in the present. This tension is like drawing from these flashbacks. That's very interesting to me.
And it works. It could be a disaster doing that because it is breaking a lot of the conventional rules of screenplay writing. But I mean, they even told me in film school, do not use flashbacks because it's a lazy tool to explain things. But it really works in this movie because what we're talking about. And there's one flashback in particular that Tim's kind of alluded to now and then that is forms the linchpin of the movie. And I don't want to give it away because I feel like it's something you really need to experience because it's a punch in the gut moment, dead center in the movie. But it stands out because you're in this, all the flashbacks up until this point, they haven't been unnecessary. They've been revealing little bit of layers, but it's not like they were essential. And then you get to this one moment in the film where you're about midway point and it keeps going back to this one scene. Like you're in the present and then it cuts back and then you're back to the present and it cuts back. And what it's cutting back to is very mundane. And you're just like, you almost start getting annoyed. Like, why do you keep going back to this point? And then you see what happens and you realize, oh, this is the key to the entire movie right here. What happened? And it's an incredible scene. I mean, that whole sequence, that flashback right there, it to me is the climax of the movie. It really, it sticks with you. The way it's shot, the music, everything comes together in that scene, and suddenly you understand Lee and what's blocking him. Yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah, I don't think it's lazy at all.
No,
I think the way that they did that was excellent. I think that would mark a difference between the two films that you can count on me, and then this one would be the way those flashbacks were used. But yeah, looking at the past as the point of reference for a character is really interesting. Versus just like you can do that in a very cheap way, and this was not that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I won't reveal the main thing that ails Lee that we learn in the flashback, but I want to reveal the basic plot. So you have this sort of call to adventure moment that happens early on. We talked about Lee kind of in this depressed funk being this maintenance man, and he gets a call from his family that his brother has died. His brother has this sort of lung disease, and he dies at an early age and is you want to think like 30s, 40s. And so his brother has a son. It's the nephew that we saw in that first scene where he was joshing around with him and fishing with him. And unbeknownst to Lee, his brother Joe has designated Lee as the guardian of his son, whose name is Patrick. And so Lee wants nothing to do with this. He's mortified that this is even happening. I don't think Patrick wants Lee to be his guardian, but yet the two of them are stuck together because no one else wants Patrick. There really is no one else. Everyone has an excuse. And so the movie is basically about Lee trying to figure out how to be a guardian to this kid who is, I want to say, 16-ish, maybe, right, Patrick? Yeah. And how to work all the details of this out, and also grieving over all the things that he's been through in his life. So that's the basic plot of the movie. But at the end of the day, this isn't a plot twisty type of film. This is a character study. These are good characters, and it's a character study. So Tim, I know you're not a huge acting guy, but just if we could return to it a second, because there's so many great actors in this movie, and they're just everyone brings their A game to this. We talked about Casey Affleck. Lee's nephew Patrick, played by Lucas Hedges, I think is really good. And it's good in a totally different way from Casey Affleck, because I was almost surprised how this Patrick, he doesn't appear to grieve that much over his dad's death. I mean, like, he kind of goes on life as usual. He's still on his phone. He still hangs out with his friends. But then there's these moments where he cracks up and you realize that he is grieving just in a different way.
It's funny, like, how much of that, because I've been around grieving kids. I did youth ministry for like 11 years, and I've been around kids who have lost parents, and he does. I'm wondering how much of that is the acting and how much is the writing. Because the writing, like when the kids start breaking into talking about Star Trek and it actually is the right way to grieve versus the girlfriend that wants to like talk about everything that happened. I mean, it's like not like talking about it's going to do anything at that point.
That's interesting. And then and Patrick even says when they break into that Star Trek moment that Patrick's girlfriend's like, hey, guys, I can't believe we're talking about Star Trek right now. But Patrick says, I want to talk about Star Trek, right?
Yeah, he's like, yeah. I like Star
Trek.
Yeah,
I like Star Trek.
And then there's these other moments where, you know, one of the running things is that the poor kid doesn't want to have, his dad doesn't get to get buried until spring because it's the middle of winter and the ground isn't thawed. So he's in a freezer for like 3 months.
And that totally freaks him out.
Yeah. And so there's this scene where I think he did such a good job where, and I'm spoiling, spoiler alert.
Okay. All right.
You want to let him see it? We can let him see it.
I think we should let him see it because it is. It's his standout moment, Lucas Hedges' performance. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. So, but I think he does a good job. I mean, he captures this adolescent kind of going between wanting to be free and irresponsible and then also taking on the weight of a heavy, heavy loss and then going between those two very without effort. It seems like to mirror actual grieving that I've seen. Mm. And so I thought he did a good job. And I think a lot of that's writing, though.
Yes. And Michelle Williams is also in this. And she plays Lee's ex-wife. It's a small supporting role, but it's a meaty one. And, you know, as I was thinking through this, so we talked about Lucas Hedges having his big scene that we won't spoil for you. Michelle Williams also has this standout scene. And you'll know it when you see it. Yeah. It's towards the end, and they're standing outside. And it's just, I mean, it's that alone could earn her a Best Supporting Actress, just this one scene. And so it's really cool in that way, is that each actor has this one moment.
This film is so hard to talk about because everything is a spoiler.
Okay? I know.
And that's, I mean, because of the way it reveals itself.
But because that's like it, the emotions are the plot twists. That, like, that's why it's so hard.
It is. And then, and then like even the idea of a brother leaving him as the guardian, that like, I can't even talk about that because it's a spoiler. And it's like what we should be talking about. It's like almost like we should do a podcast like 6 months from now and be like, here's what we were actually thinking about this. But it's so good. This film is so good that we want you to go see it, and we don't want to mess up that experience for you.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a great acting ensemble. Everybody brings their best to this, and it really does feel like a shared experience, and so that's great. I also want to talk about the music, because it's very interesting music in this. It's a very, like, larger-than-life operatic score, right, in some spots. But then there's other parts, like when it opens, that's very, like, quiet, and it's sort of like a soundtrack of grief. The music's very interesting. What do you think about the music?
So one of the things he does in You Can Count on Me, also this film, is that he mixes up, and I love this because you don't see it very often. He mixes up music that would be considered highbrow and like classical, and then opera, and then he'll put it in with country western or like metal, and it gets mixed up into these we go through these different emotional moods, and like we listen to those different things at different times. So like in You Can Count on Me, you have a woman who the mom who's cleaning the kitchen to a country music song, and then like the next time it hits, it's like classical, it's a full classical opera. It's like almost overwhelming the scene to have the that there. But I think I like it. I know, I think back to Birdman when he was using so much classical music and it kind of backfired in some ways because they didn't let him have it wasn't considered its own soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's horrible.
I look back at it, and I think there is some... He uses those classical... the classical music to evoke emotions that we might already associate with that classical music, so it's a little bit manipulative in that way.
Yeah.
And some of the songs are... He's not getting, like, really obscure pieces, and I'm not a classical music person, so I couldn't name all the pieces, but there's stuff that I would be aware of, generally speaking. Like, I'm like, oh, I've heard this 100 times. And so he's drawing some kind of emotion from those pieces.
Did you feel that sometimes the music felt almost bigger than the scene? Like, especially in the one key flashback we talked about, it almost felt like the music was taking over the scene in a way. But maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'd have to look at levels again. See, this is a movie you want to watch a bunch of times.
Yes.
But, I think of... Yeah, the levels, it seems like it's mixed really heavy in some part, in some scenes.
And right,
it's
right.
Like, the dialogue is like, I want to hear it over this, or even the expressions. But I think that he uses that as like, this is emotional filmmaking.
It is. His mise-en-scene is emotion. That's Lonergan. Everything revolves around that, and which seems like filmmaking 101, but it's not. I mean, not everyone does that. Yeah.
No, and he does it with and he uses pieces that will evoke that. I mean, in us, And it'll mm-hmm. heighten, and it'll heighten importance by taking a like music that we would consider important music and putting it into a scene. And I'd need to like, it makes me want to own the movie and then just go back and look at all the different scenes and find out what each piece was. But it's hard to do the one viewing.
We should do that. We should like have the sequel to these podcasts come back 6 months later, have seen the movie like 3 or 4 times. Everyone else has seen it. We can just dive into the meat of the thing.
Yeah, it's so different than... You know, I know we talk about Wes Anderson all the time. But like Wes Anderson, he'll take like a whole, like I, you know, I'm thinking about like Royal Tenenbaums and it'll be like a whole soundtrack full of like 70s folk and like Rolling Stones. And it's all essentially from the similar era and then a little bit of like a little bit of newer stuff that sounds like that sound.
Pretentious.
Well, it was like a little pretense, but I would say it just is very flat in some ways. If you look at like when you're done with the overall picture of it, you're like, oh, it all sounded the same.
Yeah, it's like really good music. Like it's aesthetically pleasing, but you don't feel the same like punching the gut that you feel in this. Yeah.
I feel like it goes, ooh, I should look that up and I'll add that to my list of hip-hop right? stuff. But I can't get the whole soundtrack because then it'll look like I'm just listening to Wes Anderson music.
That's how I feel too. It's like, ooh, yeah. I'll add that cool song to my alternative playlist.
Right. I'm like, ooh, girls will think this is, you know, I'm thinking like, you know, I'm very 90s-ish. I'm like, oh, maybe my girlfriend will think I'm cooler now. But I think with the music that he chooses, he takes stuff as pretty iconic and familiar to the audiences. Because I think emotions are, I mean, it's how many, I don't know how many emotions there are. That's not my thing. But he'll take something that will draw on certain emotions. So it may even be like a tragedy piece, even from opera, right? Because there's different genres of opera. And he'll put it with a tragedy. And that will heighten the experience for us.
Mm.
Yeah, it's really hard to do upon one viewing in the middle of the night.
Yes.
Draw a conclusion out of this.
Not only that, in a snowstorm in the heart of Wisconsin, a 10:05 showing. That's how dedicated we are.
We were. And like how many people were there? Like a couple like other people showed up.
Four. They even, the other theater, this is like a 2-screen theater, and the other one there was a big sign posted saying, we're sorry, the showing of Loving is like 58 degrees. It's like
yeah, like their heater kicked out. Yeah, anyways, a fun experience. It's like the opposite of our Tarantino Hateful Eight experience.
That's right, with an intermission. Yeah. All right, so we talked about the technical side of this, the plot, the acting, music, all that. But what is Manchester by the Sea really about, Tim? What's the heart and soul of this movie in your mind?
I like to me?
Yeah.
I think it's for I think it's a redemption narrative. And I think the idea is can we go from incredible brokenness to some level of wholeness, not like repaired, but can we get from such broken events in our life and can those events in some way, can we come back from, not come back from them, but even if after we've experienced those horrible things, can we have a whole narrative again? Yeah. And I think that that's what that's about. And the film, you know, there's only like, it's hard not to spoil the film by even talking about this, but I would say the film would say you can't get back what was lost but you can be wholer. You can have experienced more wholeness than you previously had, but than you were than at the bottom. So it's kind of like you fell and now you're working your way back up. I think it's about wholeness. I think about it's a reasonable idea about wholeness. It plays on our idea of like, we want to make everything right. We want perfect resolution. And this film would say there is no, that will never happen. You'll
and
never
it doesn't
get,
give it to you. Right.
No, that will never happen. Sometimes there's losses that we experience in life that are so catastrophic that they can never be righted. It's just not going to happen. But how do we live after that? And how do we live through that, you know, day to day? And so I think that this film, and I think in some ways You Can Count on Me is also that way, is that how do we live through those things?
I really like what you said, too, about Lee being in a prison of his own making. Can you expand on that a little bit more and how it ties to what you just said?
Yeah, so there's this catastrophic event that occurs.
Yep, something that he did that he can't forgive himself for.
Yeah, and so this thing happens, and so he exiles himself. He puts himself from a situation that was this great, warm, loving situation, and he puts himself into a situation where he's plunged in toilets and he lives in this underground apartment that really it resembles a prison cell.
It absolutely does.
And so he self-imposed this prison on him, and he's living in exile.
Refusing all dinner invitations, right? Just kind of living this isolated existence.
He doesn't want any human contact. And there's a sense that he doesn't feel like he deserves any human contact. And so he's doing this. He's giving himself his own sentence. And so for me, I think that plays big time into the movie, because I think there's a lot of us out there that are doing that in some way, in small ways and big ways.
So does Lee get out of his prison? Because I don't feel like he does, but I struggled with the ending a little bit because I felt like he was still trapped. But do you feel like he got out?
Well, I think to a certain degree his place is very important to this movie. So, I think he realizes that the place that he once was would be a prison to him. If he returned to it, even if he felt like it would be, you know, even if he was like, well, if I do this, this will be good. But he tried, and I think it was a prison for him, a different kind of prison. So I think like we can get into like, well, if I can only right this wrong, or if I can only make up for something I've done, and that can become just as much of a prison as if we just are like experiencing self-loathing. So these are really heavy human themes, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we're cinema faith, so we talk about faith.
Yeah.
And so the idea is like, are there some things that, you know, a great attitude and a hard work ethic can't get us, you know, of course. I think that part of our humanity is to experience deep loss and deep regret. I always talk about this scene from, I think it's The Big Kahuna, which is this I talked about it before.
I don't think so.
It's with Kevin Spacey and Danny DeVito, and I forgot the other actor. But anyway, where he's talking to him and he says, he talks about being a real person and being authentic. And he said, you begin to be like a real authentic person when you have regret. And I think that's we don't talk about that much in our culture, that we have deep regret for things. We usually just, you know, edit the Facebook post or not talk about it. So this film would like, it kind of sits in that. It sits in deep regret.
And to an extent, it leaves you there recognizing that there might not be total healing on this side of existence, right? Lee's stuck. In this movie, he's just stuck emotionally. He's running away from anything that will remind him of the pain that he's got in his heart. He, like we talked about, he avoids these dinners with people, any interactions. And he even says at one point in the movie, I can't beat it, right? I can't beat it. And I was just struck by how Lee is, he can't forgive himself. And sometimes I think that's the hardest thing to do, is to forgive yourself for things. Like, I still think about things from my past. Like, I never had a moment like Lee had in the flashback, but like just stupid little things about like a comment I made or something I did, something awkward. And I think about, I can't let it go. Like, I'm constantly going back. Like, forgiving yourself can sometimes be even harder than forgiving other people. And so I just feel like forgiveness is a huge part of this too. And for Christians, especially for us, like cinema faith, I mean, forgiveness is everything, right? We believe that the heart of the gospel is grace. That's my favorite word, by the way, grace. And I feel like the only thing that can ever even begin to break into Lee and bring some light into the darkness is grace and this knowledge that we believe that God actually loves him, that he's worthy, that he's made in the image of God despite what he's done. And I think that's what Lee needs so desperately. He needs God's grace. And I think the film's really honest about grief, you know, because even as Christians, even with that knowledge, we know that there's nothing pat about grief. There's no formula. There's no one way to grieve. And the movie just lingers in that and says, this is tough. This is a lifelong road. But I can't help but leave the movie just hoping that Lee finds that grace someday, because I think that's the only thing that'll set him free.
Yeah, I don't know. It has this director, this writer director has an interesting relationship with religion in both of these two films that
yes.
are kind of his big films, which are, and I think it portrays actually clergy pretty accurately in the You Can Count on Me. I was very impressed by that.
Mm-hmm.
And where it's a
clergy tend to try to fix everybody, or they try to simplify things or control things. And I thought that, and he's like, no, this is not simple. It's not fixable. It's not controllable. And as far as the grace goes, I think there's some ideas about grace that you get from this, but usually those, I mean, I'm seeing with the Lee character here, it seems like what brings that, this idea of grace and redemption is actually his dead brother, sets up the scenario.
Facilitated through the guardianship is what you're saying.
Through this guardianship to bring about some level of wholeness.
Yeah.
And the scene, there's a scene where he kisses his brother's dead body that shows, like, that is almost like this key to the movie, where he has to identify the body, and he very gently goes down to it and he gives him a very soft kiss on the cheek.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, because that wouldn't, you wouldn't do that with anybody except for somebody that had some huge meaning, even like,
and Lee wouldn't at the, right in present day.
Oh, like it's totally contrasted with every human interaction that he's had, including with the hospital staff, with all of the people that are in his building. Everything is harsh and without emotion. And then all of a sudden he kisses the dead body of his brother. And so you can see in some ways this, like, this man meant so much to him. And so that begins to open that up. But I think, so I look at him as being the beginning of that grace, as this dead man and some of these things that he did.
It's beautiful.
So.
All right, Tim, final thoughts. Give your overall review of Manchester by the Sea in 2 minutes. Go.
It's the return of the emotional film, and it is a triumph. I would give it probably an A. I don't know. Is that where we're going on letter grades today?
Letter grades, okay. Always.
So I would give it an A. It's a must-see movie for you in this next year. Go see it in the theater, because like we talked about how important some of these scenes are, and you're going to get a better view in the theater.
And if you miss it, they're going to be talking about it come Oscar time, and you're going to wish that you had seen it while you could, because this thing isn't coming out on
that one.
This one isn't coming out on DVD till March, so you will miss out on all the conversations. See it now.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Go with people. I mean, yes. go with a friend. I mean, even if you're, you know, just go with somebody you can talk to about it, because I think it's worth talking about. We couldn't talk about everything today because we don't want to wreck the film for you. Mm-hmm. So know that it's totally worth seeing. I would say it's a must see. And so go see it in the next few weeks.
I would agree. I'd give it an A- personally. I think it's definitely a must see movie. Casey Affleck is amazing. Kenneth Lonergan, he just brings such a unique style to his films. He's detailed. He's unhurried. He just reveals layer after layer. My only criticisms I would say would be that there's some points where the transitions feel a bit hurried. I feel like some details get lost in the mix, and I wasn't 100% a fan of the ending, but overall, this is a powerful movie, and definitely worth seeing. So, the Golden Globes announced their nominations on Monday. Manchester by the Sea is up for 5 Golden Globes, screenplay, director, supporting actress, best actor, and best picture, and I think there are more Oscar noms to come.
Are you ready for my prediction?
I'm ready.
Best actor right here.
Right here, Casey Affleck.
This is my Tim Nelson. You don't agree.
Tim called it.
Agree.
I think it's early. I'd like to see what he's up against.
All right, man. But there's a certain scene you'll know, folks. If you go see this movie, you'll know the Oscar scene. that's my prediction. If I'm right, what do I get, John?
You get a big hug.
Oh, man.
And public recognition on this podcast for sure.
Okay, so that's the I told you so.
That'll be an I told you so.
Fantastic.
Moment, for
that's
sure.
What I actually am craving.
I know that's what you like better than
most. Best actor.
Yes. So hey, thanks everyone for sticking with us, even though we didn't have a podcast last month. Again, we are coming back with another podcast for your listening pleasure in 2 weeks. La La Land is next.
All right, man.
I'm so excited to see this. By far the biggest, most talked about, buzzy movie of 2016 is La La Land, and it is finally in theaters. In fact, listeners, why don't you go see that along with Manchester by the Sea before we talk about it in a couple weeks, and we can feel a little more freedom to talk freely about it with you. And it is a modern-day musical from the writer and director of Whiplash. Which was so good. The grade A masterpiece from 2 years ago. Yes, watch Whiplash if you haven't seen that, please. So, hey, and one last thing. If you enjoy listening to us, Would you please do us a huge favor and give us a quick review on iTunes? The internet is made up of robots, and they really like podcasts with ratings and reviews. And the more of those you have, the more we're going to show up in search results for other people to learn about the show. So please, it takes 5 minutes. Just head over to iTunes and give us a review and a one-sentence remark. That would be awesome.
Cool.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Tim, thank you for a great discussion. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.